This is GeoTalks, a podcast by Blue Marble Geographics. Mike Childs is known as the Global Mapper Guru for his work creating and developing Global Mapper, the powerful GIS mapping software. In this special episode of GeoTalks, Mike joins us to unpack Global Mapper's origin story and discuss what has made it such a fulfilling project to develop over the years.
Welcome to GeoTalks. I'm Meg Scribner, and joining me as the co-host for today's episode is Blue Marble Geographics President and CEO, Patrick Cunningham. Patrick, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Meg. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So this month, Patrick, we're joined by a guest whose work with GIS technology actually inspired this show. This person has a wealth of knowledge and experience working with GIS technology and is commonly known around these parts as the Global Mapper Guru. What do you think, Patrick? Are you excited about our guest?
Yeah, of course. I'm always excited to talk to Mr. Mike Childs.
Hi, Meg, and hi, Patrick. How's everybody doing today?
Doing well. How's the weather in Colorado?
It was 100 yesterday. Not quite as hot today, but summer has arrived.
Absolutely. Mike, we're excited to have you here, especially because the show was inspired by your work creating Global Mapper. For listeners who might be tuning in for the first time, we host monthly conversations with geospatial professionals who are solving critical challenges with GIS technology. Hot off the heels of Blue Marble's 30th anniversary, we accepted the LiDAR Leader Award for outstanding innovation in LiDAR, and we've been developing some great tools in the software since then. Would you share how the year is going so far and if our listeners should anticipate anything in the coming months?
Sure, Meg. As always, we're constantly adding new features based on user feedback and what we think makes sense for the software going forward. We're doing a lot of work on LiDAR automated classification tools that are kind of machine learning based. So you can, in addition to the built-in classifications we had before for ground and buildings and trees and power lines and things like that, we've added a bunch of tools for custom classification, so you can train your classifier on things like airplanes and go find those in the data or any other thing that has a kind of a common 3D shape. You can use our segmentation tools to pull up different segments, and then you can train based on the segments and basically create a custom LiDAR classification tool. And that's what we won that award you just mentioned for was that. We're also working on a bunch of machine learning AI tools coming in the next version, or at least the next versions, for things like automatic land cover classification from imagery, object detection like vehicles from satellite and aerial imagery, and a whole lot more to come after that. In addition, we've got new analysis tools for like solar power classification, solar power calculations, and shadow finding. And a lot more that our development team is working on that'll be out in our upcoming 26.0 release in a few months.
That is stellar.
Yeah, it's going to be a great release, Mike. So one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on here is I think that our listeners would be interested in kind of the origin story of Global Mapper and, you know, how one starts a company like that. I know that it sort of started with you working as an intern for the USGS. Is that right?
Yeah, we can start it a long, long time ago in a state far, far away from Colorado or Maine. I was a college student at the University of Missouri, Rolla, which is now known as Missouri School of Science and Technology. They've renamed it since I went there. But I was a computer science student in my undergrad there and worked at the US Geological Survey, which had one of their big mapping centers is located in Rolla, Missouri. As part of that, set the stage, the year was 1996 or seven or something like that. So Windows 95 was new. So people were starting to use Windows for things. Whereas the USGS had always been a Unix shop. They used DG Unix back at the time, which I don't even know if it still exists. But with Windows 95 becoming popular and people starting to use Windows for serious work, they needed a Windows viewer for some of their data. Initially, it was just the DLG, or their digital line graph, which is a USGS vector format. So they had me as a new student toss me into the Windows realm because nobody else knew how to do it. Neither did I at the time. But I wrote an application to view their DLG products on Windows 95. As a government agency, we had a great, amazing name called DLGV32, which was a 32-bit DLG viewer. But it worked great at loading those DLG vector files and displaying them in Windows. It had like five toolbar buttons or something like that. Didn't do very much back then. Over the next few years, I continued working as an intern there at the USGS while I finished my undergrad, and we updated the application to support DRGs, their raster, kind of topo maps, and then DEMs, their terrain models got added in there at the end. By the time I left the USGS, the DLGV32 application could display, vector DLGs and DRGs, the raster and the DEM in a top-down view. It was also, as far as I know, the first application that could live reproject data. So if you loaded like a DLG in one UTM zone and you had a DIM in another UTM zone or some other projection or state plane or something, it could live reproject the raster files without you having to convert them all at the same projection and datum at the same time. I think in the late 90s, that was the first application that could do that.
I was just going to say that's definitely cutting edge software for the time. It's funny to think how far it's come, but when did you start to consider spinning it out as a company?
So after I graduated in 1998, I went and worked for Garmin, which is close to my hometown, Kansas City, at least their headquarters are. And I worked on a bunch of things there and didn't think about the DLGV32 for a couple of years. And then out of the blue, my old manager there at the U.S., contacted me and said, hey, we have some new file formats. I don't really have anybody here that's familiar with the code to add them to DLGV32. What do you think if we just release it open source? Because they can't play favorites, it's a government thing. But if they release it open source, in theory, anyone could take that and build on it. But then if I added these formats, I could, add other stuff and sell it commercially, and they would promote what I had done, the free version of it, that could just view the data and things. So I'm like, I'm sure I'll work on that. So then it was released in, I think, 2000, maybe 1999, as DLGV32 Pro initially, built on the terrible initial name, just to keep the branding, because people are familiar with DLGV32, even though it did a lot more than the name suggested. It only stayed under that name for, I think, less than a year before I brainstormed a bunch of names and bounced them off of people and ended up with Global Mapper as something that hadn't been used. That was a name that I liked. And that became really popular. The USGS still had a version called DLGV32 Pro just to keep the naming consistent for a few years, but I don't remember when that went away exactly. To answer the question, I'd say 2000 or 2001 is when it was first sold commercially, just as something I did on the side while I had my main job.
Okay, so now you have Global Mapper as a software that you're developing. You've got a name. Where did the ideas for additional features come from and growing it into kind of a company?
That's a great question, Patrick. So during the years that DLGV32 Pro / Global Mapper was at the USGS, customers would ask for new features all the time, but because USGS was a government agency, they didn't want to compete with commercial software. So things like contour generation or export to new formats, they couldn't really add, because then other kind of customers of the USGS or partners would get upset because you're competing with them with free software. So once I had it as a commercial application, I of course wasn't under any such restrictions. So I started adding things that people have requested over the years, like exports, contour generation. There was a very active user base of people that would email support, which was just me. So they'd ask for things or have bug fixes, and I would turn them around really quick. I think I ended up doing almost one release every week. So as the numbers ticked up from like DLGV32 Pro version 4.00, I think within a year I was up to version 4.79, so a little over 1 week. But back then, a release was, oh, I fixed the bug, added a new little feature, I updated a new version, it has a new version number. So people were constantly getting emails about, hey, a new version, got this new stuff, which they loved. If they requested a feature, it was usually done pretty quick, you know, if it was a small feature.
And what were you charging for the software back then?
That is also a good question. I think it started at like $79 was, I think, the first release, what it cost. And then it would increase over the years. I feel like within a few years, it had added a lot of functionality and it got up over 100. Later on in the year before the Blue Marble acquisition, I think kind of every other year I would increase the price a little bit. I discovered an odd phenomenon that I really liked, that every time I increased the price, it sold more. So kind of the opposite of supply and demand. I think people would see, oh, this costs more, this must be good software. When it was $79, they're like, oh, this must, you know, must not be that great kind of thing. Good problem to have. Obviously, that only works to a certain price point.
So it sounds like it started to take off. At what point were you able to just spin out and, you know, quit your day job, as they say?
If I think back, you know, it started out slow, but it just kept growing and growing and growing and taking more and more of my free time, you know, on the evenings and the weekends. And eventually, I'd say around 2005 or six, it kind of didn't make sense to do my normal day job anymore, because Global Mapper had grown enough that it was the more profitable side of things. So about then is when I, you know, spun off and just focused full time on Global Mapper. And then in 2008, because I was no longer tied to a job in Kansas City, I decided to look around the country and see where I wanted to move. And that's, I decided on Denver, moved there at the end of 2008, and continued focusing on Global Mapper there. Pretty much the same business model as always, of listening to customer feedback and requests and adding features based on that, doing bug reporting and spending time, you know, order processing, all the other non-development stuff. All that was being done at once. I had to make a lot of kind of automation tools to scan my email and put orders in databases and things so I didn't have to spend a lot of time doing that, because I'd much rather focus on development and new features and bug fixes and things like that.
So you mentioned that back in the day, you were the sole developer and used customer feedback to make improvements. During this back and forth with the users, did they share any cool projects or applications of the software with you that stood out?
I'm sure there were a lot that I can't remember, but a few offhand. There was a customer that I think was making a custom dim based on the Lord of the Rings. So they wanted a terrain map that kind of had Mordor and all those, all the Lord of the Rings names I can't think of right now. So somebody was doing things like that. We had a customers all over the world and resellers all over the world. So there were people in Poland doing things, and Japan and South Korea and, you know, South Africa, a bunch of South American places. So even back then, we had customers all over the world doing cool things with all kinds of wacky requests and weird formats that, you know, nobody else could support, or nobody else did support, that I was able to throw in there to make their lives easier. Even if they just wanted to convert it from that weird format to a normal format to use in some other software, it would turn to Global Mapper to do that. And people, that's a main thing people still use it for today.
Yeah, well, on the show, we speak with people who use the software worldwide, and their applications of Global Mapper have been so great to learn about. It's cool to know that the same was true at the beginning. And on that topic, before we get too far, I should mention a few things for our listeners. So every year we host the Global Mapper Master Contest and our annual academic scholarship. Both of these initiatives are pretty great because we get to see creative solutions that our users are developing and we get to celebrate them. Not to mention, we offer some pretty great prizes, some free licenses. So definitely check those out. Those deadlines are coming up.
Yes, if our listeners want to submit something for the Global Mapper Master Contest, I think we're just about to launch that, or by the time this podcast is released, it will be launched. So head to our website and submit before September 30th, is it?
Yeah, that would be great. I'll make sure to include that link in the description too. So Patrick, is that around the time that you started hearing about Global Mapper from the Blue Marble geographic side of things?
It is actually because we were adding more file format translation to our software tools. And we started to hear from customers that were saying, you know, they might like some of the stuff we were doing, but for file format translation, they really liked Global Mapper, and it became a recurring theme. So that's what led us to come knocking on your door, Mike. That was a little bit before 2011 or so, when we, you know, made the offer to acquire the company. And I guess, were you thinking you were going to take early retirement? You didn't. We were so glad you didn't.
I was probably a little young back then to do it. But yeah, it was the spring of 2011, I think, when I got an email out of nowhere from an attorney or something representing you, interested in the acquisition. And I had actually been familiar with Blue Marble before that. As in college, even when I wasn't working at the USGS, I worked, did a co-op at a place called Harman that does train controls, not to be confused with Garmin. But anyway, I did a project there where I was tracking trains with a live GPS signal, I think using the GeoTracker or some old Blue Marble application.
Yeah, the Geographic Tracker is what it was called.
Yeah, so I'd used that back in the mid-90s. I think I used the Geographic Calculator for a few things back then when I worked for Harman. So I've been familiar with Blue Marble, even back before Global Mapper was a thing. So anyways, in 2011 is when we started to get the ball rolling on the acquisition. And I flew out to Maine to meet the whole team. I was very hush-hush then, so only a couple of people at the top of Blue Marble knew anything beyond my first name or what I was doing there. I was just Mike, this random guy. I think I heard rumors that people thought I was some internet billionaire that was coming to buy Blue Marble or something. That's some of the developers and support people thought. But anyway, throughout the year, we worked out the process and the deal. So we'd be, married together and our interests were aligned, and I would stay for a long period of time after the acquisition. And then in November 1st, 2011 is when the acquisition was completed.
Right. Yeah. And that's when we brought you on as the Global Mapper guru, and you continued to still be the lead on Global Mapper ever since. So it's worked out really well.
Yeah. There's been a great team has been growing around us. I think when I first came on board, there was two or three other developers maybe assigned to start working on Global Mapper. And now we have over 10, I think. If you count some other support engineers and stuff, we might have 15 developers or so on Global Mapper, an entire QA team and a support team, and everybody around that that makes the developer job a lot easier because we can just focus on development. I do remember a funny story when Blue Marble was announcing the acquisition of Global Mapper. It was at a conference in Denver. I think there was a terrible ice storm that day, so a lot of people couldn't even come. So there was pretty limited attendance for this big announcement. I remember I even slid off the driveway, I think, getting there a little late. So it was very bad weather that day for the announcement.
Yes, I had forgotten about that. That's right. There was a big snowstorm in Denver and we were holding an in-person conference.
Yeah, that sounds really hectic, but I mean, people love the software, so it's really cool to hear about the origins of it and how it came to be what we know today. Mike, so how has the software evolved into the Global Mapper we know and use now?
That's another great question. Over the years, we've just kind of continued to add features based on user feedback. And with a big team, more than just one person, it's easier to focus for a longer time on one particular feature. Back before the acquisition, it'd be really hard for me to do a feature that was going to take 6 months or a year because there were so many other things to do. But now we can focus in on things like LiDAR to be able to handle massive point clouds. It was a big development effort to go from 10 million or so points that we could reasonably handle way back in the Global Mapper version 12 and 13 days to easily handling billions of points now and streaming it all in very quickly and doing all the analysis. That's been years of work to get that going. And then we've had other parts of the development team that redesign the user interface. And we have graphics artists now that help us with icons. There's still a lot of old point symbols in there that I drew with Microsoft Paint, basically, that look terrible. But we've updated a lot of those. And luckily, I don't have to draw anything anymore because I am not an artist. There were some cool icons in there that I think users would take pity on me before the acquisition because I couldn't draw anything. And they were like, use these for your toolbar buttons. These look better than what you drew. So there were some, if there were good looking ones before, it's because someone else drew them and gave them to me.
Well, that reminds me, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the original Global Mapper, what I call the Global Mapper disco logo that, you know, we retired eventually to kind of make it look more modern, but people still really like that old logo. Who designed that?
A user whose name I do not remember right now, but yeah, the logo he's talking about was basically the words Global Mapper, but it kind of faded from a topo map on one side, filling the letters, to a satellite or aerial imagery on the other side, which I still think it looks really cool. But yeah, a customer just provided that. So rather than just the Global Mapper text as a big background, that would be the thing that showed on the screen. You didn't have anything loaded. I really like the look of it.
Yeah, it's actually a fun fact for our listeners. For the 30-year anniversary blog that we wrote, our graphic design artist went looking for the map that's in the background of the Global Mapper logo. And we I think we found out that it was in Florida or something like that. So it's kind of a fun fact.
I don't remember which one of the team was looking for that, but they did find on the east coast of Florida, they were able to narrow in on the Gulf course or something. From the customer that made it, all I had was the, you know, Photoshop files or whatever. I didn't have any, you know, the raw mapping data or anything they used to create it.
Yeah, I remember our designer going looking for that too. On the topic of Global Mapper's growth over the years, I wanted to mention that LiDAR data processing was one area where we really meshed as a company, because with Geographic Calculator, we had already focused in on 3D data processing from a coordinate transformation perspective. And then LiDAR was a natural kind of extension of that. What were some other 3D tools that we expanded on? I know, you know, we have our pixels to points with the drone imagery processing.
The pixels to points tool is a really big one. That came around in 2016 or 17. I can't remember the exact version. But what it allows is the photogrammetry workflow. So you can fly an area with the drone and take a bunch of pictures from different angles and then turn those into 3D point clouds and meshes, ortho images, and then create terrain grids on that. Once you have a point cloud, you can do any of the normal point cloud stuff. But that's been a big focus of ours for the last almost 10 years now. And we've improved the speed a lot and the functionality. We're going to have a lot more speed improvements coming soon. We've got someone really dedicated looking at that. So that's been a big, big function we've added. In addition to the other LiDAR tools, there's more imagery analysis tools to do, you know, raster, math, pull out things from multispectral and hyperspectral imagery. All kinds of vector tools to work with, do spatial operations and cropping and editing and digitizing new things. We have an analysis tool called a flattened site plan, where you can figure out how to cut the terrain and how to orient the site to minimize the cut and fill, so you can lower the cost of your construction job or oil pad site or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, that functionality is useful across a lot of industries. My next question is for both Patrick and Mike. What's been your favorite part of working on Global Mapper?
I was going to say, if I had to pinpoint one, I think it would be the LiDAR handling and how it could quickly deal with large collections of data better than pretty much any software, and all the tools, the classification and QA, feature extraction and things like that. But beyond LiDAR, another big one is the user interface updates. So you can dock things and move them around. It just looks like a much more modern interface than the old early Windows 95 look it kind of had pre-merger when I was doing everything. And the pixels to points that we had talked about, the photogrammetry workflow, is a huge one.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. But for me, I would say one of the newer innovations we've added is support for Python scripting. And I think we're just getting that out to our user base and educating them on what it can do. But if you think about all the file formats, it's well over 300, all the different ways of processing data, geospatial data that we do, much of that is available for scripting, and much of it's available for the Python scripting. So you really, there's a lot of power there that I think our users are going to take advantage of over the next few years.
That's a really good one I didn't think about. And in the last version or so, we've added a script builder tools so that as you do things in the UI, you can record the Python script or the traditional Global Mapper script. So there's tools in there to really help you get started and see how to do things in an automated fashion that you would have done in the UI before, but now you might have to do thousands of them. And then you can easily get started in Python or traditional scripting with the script builder.
Yeah, well, I'll have to include some of our scripting resources in the description because our users have a lot of power with that functionality. Following up on the biggest leaps forward in the software, I'm curious if working on Global Mapper has brought you closer to the world of GIS, Mike.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I knew almost nothing about GIS. You know, I liked maps way back when I started at the USGS, but you know, I didn't know what a datum was back in the mid-90s. I had to learn, oh, a lat log is not always in the same place, depending on what datum it is. And I was like, what year did you measure, take that in to see which epoch of the datum and things like that. So yeah, I had to learn all that just kind of organically as customers would ask for things, and I have to go look them up to see what they're even talking about or how to do that. So I didn't have any GIS background from school, it was just computer science. So I had to kind of figure all that out. And back in the late 90s, we had the web, but it wasn't nearly as easy to find resources on things. So some of it was books or just users explaining exactly what they wanted and trying to figure it out. So it was kind of a crash course in GIS that lasted 20 years.
I love that. That's a great way to think about it. So as a bit of a surprise, Patrick has prepared a bunch of GIS trivia questions for you to test your knowledge as the Global Mapper guru. Mike, enjoy the challenge and good luck. Patrick, the floor is yours.
Okay, so I'm just going to do rapid fire. So you have to kind of answer top of mind. You might get some of these wrong. All right, you ready?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay, here we go. The USGS is part of what federal department?
The Department of the Interior.
Very good. ECW stands for what?
Enhanced Compressed Wavelet.
Very good. Blue Marble was founded in what year?
When did we have the 30 year? It was like 2 years, 1992?
The 30 year was last year, so it was 93.
That was last year?
Yep.
This is a leap year?
Okay, can you name three LiDAR formats?
LAS, LAZ, E57, XYZ.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I guess that was an easy one. I didn't know if maybe you'd be nervous and you'd start making mistakes. All right, how about this one? Name three of the five parts of a coordinate system.
You've got the projection, datum, units.
Yeah, I'll take that. That's good. There's format, ellipsoid. This is going to be probably pretty easy. Give me the top three things you can do with our pixels to points drone imagery processing tool.
You can create point clouds, ortho imageries, meshes.
You got it. That's what I have as the top three. And then give me the top three things you can do with the path profile tool.
You can display a cross-section. You can extract features along the LiDAR profile. You can display perpendicular profiles.
Okay, I'll take that. That's pretty good. And here's the last one. So every year we've been sending you over to the GeoWeek conference, which is in Denver. What was the old name of that conference?
The ILMF.
Oh, very good. Do you know what it stands for?
International LiDAR Mapping Forum?
Yeah, that's it.
Well, yeah, that's crazy. Good job.
List the top 100 datums.
List all of the 300 file formats available in Global Mapper.
Let me see. Just give me a second. File open. Yeah. 12D, 3D, 3D GR. I would have to cheat on that one.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and for sharing your story. And if you have anything to say to our listeners, anything that we should keep our eyes peeled for in the coming months, let us know now.
Thanks for having me, Meg and Patrick. It's been great to talk to everyone, or at least let people listen to us talk. One thing I would suggest is that we do have training available. I think the best place to find that is under the help menu in Global Mapper. There's a link to training resources right in there. So you can find things to hook up with, you know, some public training or custom training or whatever you want there. If you have any questions about the software, I won't suggest emailing me. I'll suggest the geohelp@bluemarblegeo.com email address. And it's been great through all the years. And wow, it sounds like a farewell right now. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, we'll have to have our listeners keep their eyes peeled on what's coming in the 26 release, like you mentioned earlier. And yeah, we will talk soon. So thank you so much for joining us on the show. And we will include links to the training and to the email address in the description. So thank you so much.
We want to thank Mike for joining us on the show. It's exciting to hear his perspective on GlobalMapper's development and evolution over the years, and it sounds like there are some exciting additions to the software anticipated in version 26. Thank you for joining us on the GeoTalks podcast, and we will see you next month. You can find our show notes, including any resources or data that we mentioned, in the description. If you enjoyed listening, subscribe to our podcast and turn on notifications so you don't miss any episodes.